You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Delegates Rob Bell and David Toscano provided their perspectives on issues that came before the 2015 legislature. The delegates spoke at the Wednesday, April 8, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV member Terry Cooper.
I'm very proud to be able to introduce today delegates Rob Bell, closer to me, and David Toscano. We can think, if we're naive, that everybody in the legislature, every elected official, is top-notch. It just ain't so. Cream rises to the top there, just like it does everywhere else, and we got some real cream here. I have had the opportunity to work with both these gentlemen, and I know them both to be very able and very articulate spokesmen for their respective positions. And they are also highly respected by their peers. David, for example, was chosen by his confreres in the House Democratic Caucus to be their leader. And an example of the respect Rob commands is that 2 years ago, when he ran in a contested race for the Republican nomination for Attorney General, the Speaker of the House went out of his way to endorse him. So I am pleased to be able to introduce these fellows. The formats will be as follows. They will each make opening statements of whatever length they'd like. David has a PowerPoint. And then we'll have questions from the audience. The questions can be by raising your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Or if you're uncomfortable standing and speaking, we'll be passing out cards. Let's begin.
I didn't just jump up sooner than Rob and therefore took the floor. No, we just talked about this because I have a little PowerPoint and I'm going to try to keep track of the time, give him equal time because there could be some slides that irritate him and he wants to comment on them, right? No, I mean, we do this enough to know that we have different points of view. We try to at least share them in a civil way. First thing I want to do is point out that we are in a unique position because we are two of the successors to the Thomas Jefferson seat. You know, Thomas Jefferson represent Albemarle County and Charlottesville, and there are actually four delegates who have portions of the seat, but we've got portions of it, and that's always a great talking point when we go out on the stump, and you'll tell us if we conform at all to what Jefferson thinks about anything. The second thing I want to point out to you is this slide is a Jim Peterson slide, and for those of you who have not been to the Capitol recently, you will know that no longer exists. And in fact, that we have renovated the Capitol since that time. So come down, take another slide, and we'll do it next year. Okay, so General Assembly. Well, you know, we've got three Democrats at the top right now, McAuliffe, Northam, and Herring. It doesn't look that way in the legislature, however, though. The Senate's pretty much split, and in the House, it's 67 Republicans and 32 Democrats, and we're going to ask Terry Cooper to comment about what redistricting has to do with all that. A bunch of elections since the last session. We won't go into that, but there have been 70 new members of the House since I took office in 2006, and I don't know, maybe 74, 75 since you came. A lot of turnover. Busy session, everything from budget ethics reform to rate freezing and coal tax credits related to Dominion Power. We'll talk about some of those as we go along. We're also going to talk about cabinet sexual assault and DNA database expansion, which are actually two bills that Rob and I worked on. I thought it was kind of an interesting way of bipartisanship to get those bills passed. Who says we don't have fun? Can you see that? Right. Okay, so, well, we did consider a bill that would allow us to carry around ninja stars and brass knuckles. It was passed by the House 56-42. The next day we decided it wasn't such a good idea, and we defeated it 83-17. Who says consistency is the hobgoblins of small minds, right? We did pass a bill called the National Day of the Cowboy, so, you know, write it on your calendar. It's Saturday in July, National Day of the Cowboy. state songs. Now we've got two state songs, you know, so you can look that up too. Kind of interesting. We did have a discussion about whether we wanted to convene a new constitutional convention. After a debate and debate and debate and debate, we actually rejected that, which is kind of interesting in the House. There were some bills proposed to put guns in schools and airports. They were not, did not get to the floor this year. They have gotten to the floor in years past, but not this year. Personhood, we didn't get that either. A lot of attacks on the federal government this time around, mostly related to climate change. I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions about climate change. Usually do. I mean, one of the good things about this group is you guys don't shy away from difficult questions. So thank you for letting us be here, because we get to take the difficult questions and we all answer them correctly, right? Okay, so the budget was good. We got a bipartisan budget. We got it on time. We got out on time. This is a short session. You know, the launch session is next year, 60 days. This year was 45 days. It did include modest pay raises for teachers and state employees, some limited increases in higher education. In my view, the K-12 funding is still inadequate, but teachers did get a raise. There was no expansion of Medicaid in the budget. In fact, there weren't a lot of debate about, wasn't a lot of debate about Medicaid expansion this time around, as compared to last time around, where I gave so many speeches on Medicaid expansions that they created an entirely new YouTube channel just for me. All right, campus sexual assault. I know Rob is going to want to talk about this. You know, both of us were very concerned about what happened in with the Rolling Stone article and trying to encourage a system to develop the universities that would encourage survivors to come forward and report when appropriate and make sure that universities were reporting when appropriate in order to catch the bad guys, which is always appropriate. It was a very complicated bill, and a lot of it has to do with how you deal with the federal legislation that sort of is the overlay on all this. But we came up with something good. There are some minor tweaks that the governor has made in the bill, which I don't think anybody has really heartburn about. So this bill will be passed and will go into law pretty soon, July 1st. DNA database expansion. This is a bill that Rob and I both worked on. This came out of the Hannah Graham case and Jesse Matthew and a desire to try to find ways that you can try to find criminals before they commit the next crime. If the DNA had been taken from Jesse Matthew when he had been convicted of a previous misdemeanor offense, that DNA would have been in the database when there was a rape in Fairfax County several years ago. When they tried to do the match, they would have found his DNA. There would have been a hit on this, and Jesse Matthew probably wouldn't have ever met Hannah Graham. So what this bill does is extends the taking of DNA, which is just not very intrusive. You take a little swab, put it under the cheek, and putting that in the database for a small number of misdemeanor crimes. I say small number because when some of these bills went in at first, it was every serious misdemeanor conviction, not just being charged. You had to be convicted. You would take the misdemeanor, you would take the DNA and put it in the database. That's a very expensive proposition. We didn't have enough money to do every single crime, so we put some new ones in place which will allow the taking of that DNA. Ethics reform. There's a prohibition against taking gifts in excess of $100. After we passed the bill, we found that there might be permission to take a series of gifts that were $99, $99, and $99. The governor's now changed that, so there would be a prohibition of aggregate gifts in a single year of $100. This is a much better bill than what we've had in the past, much better law. Some people have some issues with ethics reform. I don't think either of us have them, but we'll see what happens in the General Assembly. Dominion rate freeze bill, we can talk about that in a little bit. What remains to be done? Some issues about coal tax credits we will discuss in a little bit. Medicaid expansion, this has been supported by most business groups and hospitals. We have had a very difficult time expanding Medicaid to 400,000 uninsured Virginians. There is some good things in the budget, though, that expands Medicaid in a little different way to about between 20 and 40,000 Virginians who have serious mental disabilities. But it isn't the full-blown Medicaid expansion that a lot of us wanted. Redistricting, that will be an issue we'll continue to discuss, but I don't want to take all the time that Rob may want. Reconvene session comes next week. That's when we look at all the governor's vetoes. I think there are about 20 vetoes the governor has made, and then all the line item changes he's made to bills. We take that up next Wednesday, and then we'll be done. All these things then go to the governor's desk, and the laws take effect July 1st. This is where you find me. If anyone wants to help people, other people find me, they can look at a bumper sticker and take that home. And I thank you very much for your time.
I don't have a fancy slide. I think it's pretty neat. So, is this okay? So, thanks for having us back. This is something that David and I do, I think, every year. So this is the 14th or 15th. And I think most of you understand we are part-time legislators, which means we go to Richmond for a couple of months, typically January, February. This was a short session. And then we come home. And this is not like Washington where there's big staffs and people in houses and two houses and all the rest of it. We live in apartments or hotel rooms down in Richmond for a couple of months, but we're back. And so for the last, we're just laughing about the trying. We're both lawyers. I actually work in the law firm that's right above his law firm. He's my landlord. And the difficulty of trying to kind of, if you were hiring a lawyer and your lawyer said, well, gosh, for 2 months a year, I'll be basically inaccessible. And for the rest of the year, I'll be going to things like the senior statesman. You might find another lawyer. That is true. And so we're just, we both are doing law work. We're having a harder time getting paid doing the law work. So what I'd like to do is talk about some of the highlights of session. David did a nice overview. I'll focus on some of the bills that I worked on and some local bills of local interest. One of the things I've learned is we all have plans in the summer. So if you ask us right now what we'll be doing in the next session, we have some vague ideas. And so over the year leading up to session, I'm a member of the Crime Commission, I'm the co-chair. We had worked on human trafficking, for instance. And so we were looking at, frankly, the ways that prostitution has changed and how the old laws, if you think you knew what prostitution was 30 years ago, it's nothing like that anymore. And we sort of had a prostitution law focused on where the women are taken, a brothel, and who sort of helps organize them, who was the pimp. That was a good law in the 1970s and 80s. It's now run out of the back of an SUV by someone, usually with people from not who are not legal immigrants, and they're using the immigration status as extortion. It's an entirely different problem. And the real problem would be police that are locally inclined are just happy to get it out of their community. And so if they get in the back of the SUV in Norfolk and they drive to Richmond, the Norfolk cops are done. They've done their job. Norfolk doesn't have the problem anymore, but it hasn't fixed the problem. And so that was one of the things we were working on I thought would be a focus of the session. The second is we are continuing our work on mental health reform. There's a four-year panel that Creed Eads put together. I think everyone understands. Most of you are probably his constituents. But Senator Deeds had a terrible tragedy in his family involving his mentally ill son, and has sort of taken this on as his life goal, and I think it's good for the Commonwealth, it's good for the mentally ill, and frankly, it's good for Cree, who I think is a friend. And so we will have some massive changes, I think, at the end of 4 years, but we made a commitment to ourselves that if we see things along the way, why wait? We don't have to wait for the 4 years because this is an ongoing issue, and so we've worked on that, and we had some issues about making it easier to transport people. That sounds ridiculously mundane, but in fact, that's one of the issues, because in smaller communities, the deputy that makes the arrest is also the one that has to transport someone often all the way across the state to where the bed is. The sheriffs don't like their people being off the road for that length of time. This was actually causing trouble, and we came up with, I think, a sort of a thoughtful compromise to let family members do it when the person is at risk but not so dangerous that they can't sit in the back of mom's car. And I know that sounds small, but we actually worked a long time on that. That was what I thought the session was likely to be about. And then what happened, of course, we had a series of events locally. We had the Hannah Graham case, and then we had the Rolling Stone article. And between those two, that was my session. My session was spent much more time on those issues than what I thought we'd be doing. So let's start with Hannah Graham first. There are many, many tragedies of the Hannah Graham case, but one of the issues was that if, in fact, it turns out to be Jesse Matthew, we had him already. We already knew him because he committed a rape up in Fairfax. And so this is not some random event that for the first time someone goes off and commits a crime. We had him. And then subsequent to that, he did a number of things. He committed a misdemeanor offense, which if we collected his DNA at the time, we would have found the DNA from Fairfax. And he had two other sexual assault issues, and I won't go any further than that, but one in Lynchburg, one in Christopher Newport University, both of which, had they been or had he been arrested, because in Virginia for a felony, if you get arrested, they take your DNA upon arrest. Had he been arrested, they would have found the DNA from Fairfax. And even if those cases hadn't gone anywhere, he would have been taken for the case in Fairfax. That looks like a very strong case. He would have never met, as we say, Hannah Graham, Morgan Harrington. So that was the first issue. And so David identified at least one of the things we did. We looked at the DNA list, and we added some misdemeanors to it. So if you're convicted of certain misdemeanors, you will have your DNA drawn. And if it catches a previous DNA on the list, we'll find you. The second was more technical, but also important. For the longest time, of course, we hadn't found Ms. Graham's body. And that may sound, there are occasionally murder cases where the body's not found. It only works if you know where it happened. And so that case in Nelson, which was local to us, it's already very unusual, but they knew where it happened. They just couldn't find the body. In our case, we couldn't find where it happened. We don't know if it was in Charlottesville. We don't know if it was in Albemarle. We don't know if it went way out to the country and came back. And so we were working on a change to the law, even as the investigation proceeded, to allow that case to proceed somewhere. This is called venue. Venue is supposed to be just where the case is located. It's not supposed to resolve a case. It's supposed to say, well, not Charlottesville, but Albemarle, but not Albemarle, but Nelson. And so we came up with a default venue to make sure it could happen somewhere. Now, the third thing is this issue of campus sexual assault. And if you're in this room for the first time and never had thought of this before the Rolling Stone article that makes you a normal person, this is something that's kind of been circulating in the higher education and sexual assault community for some time. I'd actually had meetings with some of the sexual assault advocates before anybody had heard of Jackie or Rolling Stone. And candidly, there was no huge impetus to do everything. It's a very hard and complicated issue, so probably nothing would happen. And then the Rolling Stone article broke, of course. And then this last week, I guess last 2 weeks, we've had both Chief Longo step forward and say that his people investigated it and just determined that it had not happened the way it was reported. And then the Columbia School of Journalism just did their big report to the Rolling Stone article and said the same thing, that this report itself was not factually accurate. The bigger issue, though, is what do we do when a campus administrator gets information that a sexual assault has been committed on campus? So they now know it. Somebody came forward and says, I was raped last night. I was passed out and woke up with a guy on top of me. There's a video circulating that I did something. What do they do? Now, the default answer, the answer I think most people come to is, we'll call the cops. Call them right away. That's certainly what I think most people think. There are multiple problems with that. The first would be federal law. Federal law requires a confidential way to report this information. It's part of Title IX. Title IX was intended to be a sexual harassment code for colleges. It has become bigger than that, and now it's used for these sexual assault issues in addition to just harassment and discrimination. But they require a confidential way to report. So that's problem one. Problem two, the sexual assault advocacy community is very concerned anytime that you take away the victim's choice on when and how to report. In other words, they want the victim to have autonomy in how to proceed. So that was the issue. And the issue came on, and I think we had a difficult balancing act between protecting the needs of this victim, the woman that makes the report, the one who tells her English teacher, something horrible happened, I don't know what to tell, I don't want to tell the cops, but I want to tell somebody, and then preventing, as we say, the next victim, which would be that guy is still out there. The studies say that the men who do this do it over and over. How do we make sure that if she doesn't tell the cops, she'll be okay? The chance of him doing it to her again is almost zero. But how do we make sure it doesn't happen to another girl the next Saturday or a month later or a year later? That was the issues. And so what we did is we had multiple meetings, and we met with all the presidents of the universities, had strong feelings. UVA predictably had a strong advocacy role. They hired terrific lawyers to kind of just walk through these rules. And we came up with the following answer, and I don't pretend that this is perfect, but this was our answer. All right, the first would be, in general, the information will be kept confidential. So if someone reports it, it's her claim. She's the one that can choose whether or not to go to the cops. Under no circumstances will she be required to go to the cops. You couldn't do it anyway, but we wanted to make clear that this is not about her. But if someone on campus has the information, what do they do? Well, the first thing is we said, let's report it up the chain until it gets to somebody. So we created a committee. It's the Title IX coordinator, the student affairs coordinator, and the campus police. They immediately get together and decide, does this endanger the health or safety of the public? And you could think of two cases. The most obvious would be It's the third time he's done it. He did it one Friday, did it the next Friday, did it the third Friday. You finally get the report. I think most of us would agree that person is a menace, and we need to proceed even if the victim doesn't want us to. And you would say, we'll make this as easy for you as we possibly can, but he's going to do this to somebody else. We have to proceed. On the other end would be something that happened 3 years ago. There's no evidence that it happened to somebody else. That may well be the kind of case where you say, we're going to give the victim a lot more autonomy in the first category. Now, the second thing was, once this decision is made, we wanted someone outside the university context to have an overview. Because while there's no evidence this happened in Jackie's case or the Hannah Graham cases, we're always concerned that you have some very powerful person, some very rich person, some future donor's son who gets in some trouble. And you don't want everybody in that room saying, oh, come on, we can work this out. I don't think this is so important. We don't really have to go to the cops, do we? And so what we said is, if they don't notify the cops, if they don't decide there's a health and safety exception, then they'll notify the local prosecutor, the Commonwealth's attorney. It's not perfect. We didn't want to keep spreading the information further and further, because the whole idea would be, obviously, this is something the victim doesn't want to have proceed. But we will have it reviewed by the prosecutor. And if they decide they want to proceed, then they can notify the local cops, and it can go that way. The only other thing is, we said, it's not fair to victims to kind of fool them into giving information. And so we're going to inform victims that this is what happens. So nobody releases information and then is surprised about what the next step is. And every college will have to have an off-campus, unaffiliated sexual assault agency that they can go to for advice. Now, in our community, we have Sarah, but the idea would be, it's just another back door if the person they ask for advice is also working for the president of the university, who's also who the police are working for. So that was the bill, and it was attacked on all sides, from people that thought it went too far, people that thought it didn't go far enough. The final compromise is, as I described, David was very helpful in getting it passed, and the governor has made some amendments that I'm probably in far more detail than people in this room care about, but I'm happy to talk about the governor's amendments. There are some interesting issues about what happens when it happens overseas, what happens when it happens in a foreign country. If this is on spring break in Florida, is it different than if it's in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and what the rules are, and who do you tell, and who are the cops, and who are the prosecutors, that kind of thing. Now, what David said, just to wrap up, we are in the period of time when we have voted on the bills and the governor is considering all of them. We go back on April 15th to take up both his vetoes. He has 17 vetoes this year, including a bill of mine. And then more frequently, this is not civics class, but it's the amendments. And every governor has a chance to amend every bill, not just up or down veto, but say, it's a good idea, but I think you should make these changes. Frequently, those are not hostile. So, for instance, on the sexual assault bill, we had been talking about some of these issues. You run out of time. And you said, this is as good as we can do in the time we have, but I hope the governor will keep looking at it. And in this case, in that bill, in fact, that's what happened. But we'll take up all of his amendments, and then we go home. And that's it for the year. This is an election year. We don't anticipate an extended session. I'm not aware of any plans for one, but we'll go back on April 15th and come back late that night. So I appreciate everybody's time and attention. I'm happy to talk about these or other issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob and David. We'll now open it for questions, but we're getting the microphones, and wait for the microphone before you ask your question and speak into the microphone, because we're taping all this.
Thanks for coming. I know there's a lot of humor associated with the idea of the ninja stars and other things and the conversation that went on, but there's a very troubling part of the section of the Code of Virginia that basically states that possession of some of these items is prima facie evidence of your intention to sell. And by having by selling is what would be a violation of the code, and you would be guilty of a class 4 misdemeanor. And it just seems outside the idea of innocence being assumed when you say, if you have something in your possession, you have the intention to sell it, and then therefore you are guilty of a class 4 misdemeanor. I was hoping in that discussion of that particular bill about, you know, switchblade knives and other things, that this would be remedied. I don't see any place else in the Code of Virginia where the state has legislated that they know your intention and you are now guilty of a misdemeanor because of that assumption of your intention. Was there significant discussion about this, and would you be willing in the future to eliminate that idea that the state has the authority to understand our intentions and then define us as being guilty? Thank you.
All right, so there's about three issues packed into what you said. So the issue about weapons, the first is the concealed weapons statute, and that says you can have weapons, but you can't conceal them. That's sort of thing number one. And most of these weapons are defined as concealable weapons, and if you have them, if you have a knife and have it in your pocket, now if it's a pocket knife, it would be a strange case, but you can certainly have a concealed weapon to have concealed. The second is what you're describing, which would be the possession statute. Now, it is a strange statute, because they could simply say these are contraband, and in other words, not have any presumptions or prima facie or anything. As you say, it's intended, I believe, and it's been a while since we looked at it, this came on this year for the first time in my knowledge, is a selling statute. You're not supposed to sell these. And then the question is, what you said is there's a prima facie. Prima facie means they assume that if you have something, it means something. That's sort of what it means. And so the prima facie case would be if you have these at all, we're going to assume you're selling them, but you can still disprove it, as opposed to if it's just a simple possession statute where any possession is illegal. I don't pretend to have spent much time thinking about it. There are a handful. I think I know the criminal code pretty well, but I'm not thinking. I think there's a couple of other places where we say there's sort of a setup where we're going to give you a chance to disprove it, but otherwise we're going to make a presumption that we don't want to make it all possession. We know how hard it is to prove that you're selling, because no one would ever run a sting operation into a store, I would think, just for some throwing stars. I don't have strong feelings about it.
Well, you know, it is interesting because there are sections of the criminal code, and again, I don't practice criminal law and I'm not in criminal courts, but there are sections of the code where you can violate without the intention to do anything. I mean, if you are carrying a concealed weapon without a permit, it's a violation of law, even though you may never intend on using that weapon. So there, I think, and there are probably a number of other cases there where it's not implied an intent to do something, but you'd still be violating the law. There was not a lot of discussion about this bill. It did not, if I'm not mistaken, it went through the Militia and Police Committee. I don't think it went through the Courts Committee. Is that right? It didn't go through the Courts Committee, so it never got bound up in this issue about intention or anything like that. It just came out of the Militia and Police Committee and went right to the floor. And then it was more about the question, it was more of a discussion about whether people should have the ability to have these things in their possession or not, rather than intent and esoteric discussions about the criminal law. And then I think the reason it was defeated ultimately is for political reasons. And I think nobody wanted to be in favor of being able to have in their possessions ninja stars and that sort of thing. I think that's why it was defeated. But I think your question is very involved, and I think it goes to the heart of a lot of things that we do in the Courts Committee, especially on the criminal law side, where Rob chairs, you chair the criminal law sub. They deal with that all the time, those issues all the time. It's very complex. That's why Criminal Courts Committee meets off until 1 in the morning, and, you know, they're debating these things as long as they can go.
Am I on? I was trying to search. I mean, bad checks have a prima facie expectation. There aren't many. Your basic point is correct. I mean, the places you can commit a crime truly by accident, meaning you didn't mean to do anything, are limited. Gosh, speeding. If you sell alcohol to somebody who's underage, there's a pretty absolute requirement. You're expected to check. And if you even look at the thing and get it wrong, even in all good faith, you are found guilty. There aren't many or. So, I mean, your basic point is right, though, that we have very few prima facie requirements in the code.
Rape.
Statutory rape's another one. Anybody who's under 12?
We have three questions from three different people on the same subject, so I guess it's important to at least three people. And these concern the restructuring of the ABC board. Could you comment on those?
Well, yeah, I can go first. I don't want to speak for Rob, but based on our discussions, I mean, I think both of us have heartburn about ABC agents enforcing laws that more appropriately can be enforced by local law enforcement and overzealously enforcing those laws as well. And so, you know, a couple of years ago when we had the incident in Harris Teeter, I put in a bill where a weapon actually was drawn. I put in a bill that would have prohibited the ABC agents from threatening the use of deadly force in affecting an arrest for underage drinking or possession. And that bill went absolutely nowhere. But I think that this incident really has gotten a lot more attention, and really I think we're going to see some pretty big changes in the ABC, either through policy enacted by the agency itself, or if not, by changes in the statute. I think that people are sick and tired of this kind of overzealous enforcement. You know, that being said, there are some places where it makes sense for ABC to continue to do what they're doing. That's particularly in terms of the regulation of the facilities themselves. Like if you've got a bar that is selling underage to underage people, now that may be a more appropriate role for the ABC to go in there and bust them. Or if you're looking at stills in the countryside. But this notion that somehow we ought to have this police force out there enforcing underage drinking, I think has gotten a lot of us really very concerned. So I think you'll see some legislation on this.
Yeah, the question was about restructuring the board. I think that was sort of independent of this, of course, because that came up before this happened. But the restructuring the board would be to make it more like a business, less like a place you send politicians who are going out to seed for the last 3 years. It's always been sort of a plum reward for people because the salary is so high. I think everybody supports that. That's passed. The bigger issue is what should we do with ABC? And I think that there's what David said is right. There are sort of three things that ABC does generally. The first would be they sell the liquor. They have the ABC stores. The second is the licensure role. There are all these rules for places that sell alcohol. So, for instance, if you're a restaurant that sells alcohol, you have to sell a certain amount of food. If you sell hard liquor, it's a much higher percentage. And so you might say bars in Virginia. We don't have bars. We have restaurants that sell alcohol, and they always have to have, you'll see that the bars that serve liquor often have a really good lunch buffet, a good dinner. The reason is they're trying to get their food sales up. Okay. I don't think that that is an issue that local police want to do, are particularly skilled at. This is something that should be handled by something called ABC. You don't need a badge and a gun. This is just people running numbers. Now, the everyday enforcement of drunkenness cases. So if you go down to the coroner on a Saturday night and stay there for 6 hours, someone is going to get arrested for something. And it happens every week, and some of them actually come see me and hire me. This is a common case for all of us lawyers in town. But what the issue would be is that Charlottesville Police does this by the hundreds. I mean, three or four a weekend, 50 weeks a year, more for Foxfield, more for St. Patrick's Day. The county police don't have quite so much city-looking area, but they also have 100 a year, 150. And then the UPD, University Police Department, have their own. And they often are trying to get kids home more than arrest them, but they also have cases that are so extreme they feel the need to get them to the jail to make them safe. I'll tell you, since Hannah Graham, the arrest went way up. And you could visualize why. If Hannah Graham had been arrested and put in a paddy wagon and woken up with a hangover in Charlottesville's jail, she would be working, you know, she'd be working for a summer job. And so the police, the word clearly went out, and I don't know if it was formal or just every cop read the paper and said to himself, if a kid is really impaired and I can't get them home, I'm going to take them to jail. So we saw an increase. So I have personally handled 100 of these cases, 150, some very large number. The community has handled, in the last 14 years, probably 5,000. These are a very common charge. About the worst two cases I have ever seen was the case where a gun was drawn and an officer is, you know, trying to make a takedown of a car in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. And, you know, Martiz, who got 10 stitches, thrown on the ground over what appears to be a false ID case. There's only one commonality between these two cases. I mean, they, you know, different ages, different colors, different. Everything else is different, which is actually good because it lets us, with just two data points, focus in on where the problem is, and it's ABC. I don't see why ABC has any particular expertise in this. In fact, what it appears to be is just the opposite. When they do these cases, they do a bad job of it. And so I'm with David. I think that we need to wait for the state police report to come out. Obviously, there could be different facts that we haven't heard that change everybody's whole view of things. But I haven't seen them yet. There is one thing left that I think David mentioned that I'm not sure how to handle. This would probably be best handled through state police if we want to keep it. When you do underage buy-sell, meaning you send a 19-year-old in just to see if they'll sell to you, there are reasons why you might want to have badged and gunned law enforcement nearby. And then out in the country, when you're breaking up stills, you have to have it. And that's a dangerous job, and someone has to be armed. If we want to keep that at all, it seems to me the state police is fully trained and competent and capable to do that. Let's just transfer that over to the state police, let the local cops do the drunken public cases, and let ABC do licensure in the stores.
Terry?
Dave? One little follow-up, which I think is relevant to this. You know, the governor got out front very quickly on this case, and he issued an executive order that had
a number of good things in it, but one of the good things it had in it was a requirement that the ABC develop memorandum of understanding with local police divisions. And I would have thought that already would have existed, but apparently it does not. And that's a really good thing, because that will allow some understanding with the local police divisions when ABC is coming in to do something, and potentially have local police divisions have some say over where they go and what they do. And that's not the case, and there are a number of these university towns, Harrisonburg, Williamsburg, Charlottesville, you know, Radford, I mean, you could name them, where it could be very productive long-term.
Real quick, one more thing, just to play off what David said. The ABC told us they'd fix this. So you might wonder, why didn't this happen last time? Well, you had the agency step up, and they hired new people, and they brought in the sheriff of Fluvanna. And they hire people that are from law enforcement. So my conclusion is there's something cultural going on, because these were people that didn't have use of force issues when they worked for the police departments before. They get to ABC. And in 2 years, in our town, you have two of the worst, again, use of force issues I've seen. And it's just so, if you're wondering why it didn't happen last time, it's because they swore high and low that they would fix it. I don't hear much sort of willingness to give them another shot. They had a shot. They blew it.
Thank you very much for coming. I have a question. Charlottesville and the University of Virginia have been maligned all over the world. I've got things from Brazil and Europe and stuff. Can the Attorney General do anything? Can the Attorney General do anything to sue Rolling Stone on behalf of the university or on behalf of the Commonwealth?
As you know, the fraternity has filed a lawsuit, which, you know, I don't know if I was advising them whether I would do that, because it opens them up to all kinds of discovery about what they've done in the past and what various members of that group have done. But they decided to file it. I think the university pretty much wants to figure out a way to get this behind them, get certain rules in place, and move on. Because if they were to file some lawsuit, you know, that creates all kinds of problems for them. But I mean, it's terrible, because, you know, how do you get your reputation back? There are a lot of people. That Rolling Stone piece got much more publicity than the Columbia journalism piece and press conference did last week. I mean, people are absolutely convinced that this happened the way Rolling Stone said it happened. And we know pretty clearly it didn't happen that way. So, you know, I think in theory they could file a lawsuit, but I don't think they have any stomach to do something like that.
I don't think either David or I do this kind of case, but it's called defamation law. You've heard slander, you've heard libel. That's what defamation is. And you'd have to prove that it was false. You'd have to prove that it caused damages, and there's some other parts to this. It is almost impossible to defame a public official. There's almost nothing you can say about us which is considered defamatory. The truth is always a defense in defamation. The fraternity is sued. They obviously suffered major damages. UVA certainly has damages. I mean, they say that the donations are down by tens of millions of dollars off of the projected amount. Now, you'd have to prove what they would have gotten absent the article, which would be difficult. I suspect, like David, that they're going to decide the better course is just to move on. If you are ever defamed and come to us, we will probably give you the same advice, which would be just what David said. In addition to making sure everybody hears what the accusations were, and in addition to spending 2 years of your life reliving this awful moment, everything about you is game. And so since your damages are your damages to your reputation, if in fact your reputation was built on something false, that'll come up, they'll talk about it, and many people who have sued on defamation grounds at the end of 2 years say, oh my gosh, dumbest thing I ever did. I wish I could go back in time and just put it behind me and move on. I suspect that's what UVA is going to do. Your original question was, can the Attorney General do it? I don't know the answer to that. And which of us is your delegate? Is it, whose district do you live in? I don't remember. Okay, I'll be happy to look into it and just get back to you. That'd be fine.
Inequality is a serious problem that drags down our economy and that threatens our social environment. When will the General Assembly finally expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act And when will they raise the minimum wage so that fewer people will need Medicaid?
Softball. Knock it out. He's going to make you happy, so let him go first. And then...
He said it was a softball. Knock it out. But I don't know the answer to it, though. That's the problem. You know, I've been crusading for Medicaid expansion for some time. You know, because I think that it makes sense from an economic point of view, and I think that's why the Chamber of Commerce and the hospitals and, you know, most business groups have advanced the notion of Medicaid expansion, creates jobs, and it helps people along the way. I don't think it solves the problem of inequality. I think you're raising a bigger issue, and if we want to take on the issue of inequality, then you do get into wages. I don't think that the General Assembly is about to raise the minimum wage independent of the fact that I think it'd be a good idea to do it in a phased way. All the studies that I've seen, independent of the ideological arguments against it, suggest that raising the minimum wage in a phased fashion does not have a detrimental impact on jobs. I mean, that I have not seen a study that suggests if you do it in a phased way, it has that impact. Now, it is true that if you were to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, that might have an impact on jobs, and that's why a lot of us don't think that's a good idea. But it does make sense to raise the minimum wage, and there's another economic reason for that. It's called the velocity of money. I mean, the more money you get in the system, the more the economy grows. And what we're what's happening in the United States today, I think a lot of people know this, is that the growth of the economy is being inequitably or unequally distributed. It's going to the top. It used to be in a day where you had trade unions who bargained for higher wages, it sort of forced the prevailing wage rates up altogether. You don't have that anymore. And so the people who control these large institutions are skimming this off the top, and you can see it. Our inequality rate in America is greater now than any time in a long, long time. You're talking decades. And I think it's now some economists are saying that is having a drag on creating a drag on the economy. It also has an impact of not being able to recruit good workers, and that's why McDonald's raised their wage. They want to be able to recruit better workers, and they think they're going to have to pay them to do it. So, huge issue. I don't see where the General Assembly is going to do very much about it, even though I'm going to vote for it every time it comes up.
Okay, so the question, two parts. The first would be expanding Medicaid. I think that, I think we talked about this last year, but I think a critical part of this is to recognize we already do and already have. Medicaid has grown enormously just under my tenure, but I've been there 14 years, but if you go further back, let me sort of walk through the numbers. So Medicaid has grown by 1,600%. That's 1,600% in the last 30 years. It has doubled in spending in the last decade. And I think the most sort of useful metric is the percentage of the state budget that it's taking up, because all of those things are true, but the budget grows, there's inflation, the state gets bigger. Medicaid was 5% of our state budget, it's now 21%. Now that's without any expansion related to the Affordable Care Act. That is simply the increase in cost per person and the increase in people that are on it. Now, the president has made a proposal, as I think everybody knows, to expand the number of people who are eligible for Medicaid. And those of us who are skeptics, I don't want to speak for anybody else, the reason I am skeptical is because we have not made the reforms that would be necessary to change the upward trajectory.
Ma'am, you're out of order.
The upward trajectory of Medicaid, which has grown from 5% to 21%, which has doubled in the last decade, hasn't been changed. And the changes that would be necessary are going to be very difficult, very unpopular, and people in this room, including the two of us at this table, are not going to want to make them. Now, that's simple math. Now, as this increases in size, the governor has proposed, through the president's program, to add, and this, you could argue about the numbers, but between 280,000 and 400,000 people. And when we talk to him, or his representatives, about these reforms that would be necessary to, as they say, bend the cost curve, to stop this upward trajectory of spending, the thought is that we'll make those as we go. In other words, take the money now, and once those people are on the rolls, then we can make those hard choices about Medicaid going forward. With respect, I submit that will not happen, that these choices are hard enough before you add between 280 and 400,000 people to the rolls, and giving them something and then immediately changing it out from under them is not a sustainable program. Now, I respect everybody in this room. I assume you come here with good faith choices, and you, I can sort of sense the mood of a room, I gather. Most of you disagree with that. But if you are saying that we need to make these additions, I'm not making any great presumptions or promises. I'm just looking back at what's happened in the last decade. If I had come here 10 years ago, or I was here actually, when I was here 10 years ago, and you all had said, we have this just pie in the sky request. We want you to double Medicaid spending in the next 10 years. We think it should be double what it is. We want you to work toward it, and maybe in 10 years you can get there. And I had said, sure, you would not believe me. And then you would have further said, well, gosh, if we could ever get to that number, well, that's it. We will have achieved everything that's realistically achievable in Medicaid expansion. We are there. I mean, so, no, that's all. I mean, I'm just saying that I think that absent the reforms that are necessary, we cannot expand Medicaid. To do so is unsustainable, and to deny that is to not look at the numbers that are in front of you. Now, right now, just to give David's side or your side its due, there are federal dollars that could be used for Medicaid in Virginia right now. That's federal dollars means taxpayer dollars that goes to Washington. I just don't believe that that's a sustainable model. I don't think it would be safe going forward, and I think we have already seen what happens under the current Medicaid approach, which is we've gone from 5% to 21%, and if you look at the trend lines, this is not something that you've paid it down. It's not like World War II where you've made the final payment and now the war is over and you have a peace dividend. The trend lines continue further and further, and if there is anything else you want us to do, anything, reduce the tuition at UVA, pay teachers more, get you better roads, build bigger prisons, build better prisons, take nobody in prison and give them work training, whatever it might be, give you tax relief. That money is going to go forward, going forward is going to go into the Medicaid expansion that we already have in the book. So that's why I do not oppose the Medicaid expansion as proposed. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you both for coming. I know you're really busy, but there's nothing more important than letting citizens be educated about what's happened in the General Assembly. I think I'm doing something awful here. My question involves not a bill that you passed, but one that you never got a chance to vote on, and that is the proposal to create a fair and independent redistricting commission for the state of Virginia. Right. It's so loud. It's scary. Okay. This would replace the current system where legislators essentially redraw their own lines at the every decennial census. What we would like to know, and I think people in this room are probably pretty knowledgeable about redistricting, is how you personally, philosophically stand on the issue of an independent redistricting commission.
All right, so we're going to reverse this. So
maybe I should answer it for you.
You could. There was one time, this was the League of Women Voters, where David had to leave early, and I went through and gave both answers going forward because we'd done it so many times. All right, so let's talk about redistricting, because this is a topic about which there's been some actions in the last few months that are going to impact perhaps what you're talking about. So first, the redistricting is done after every census. You take a population. We have 100 delegates, 40 senators. The congressman changes a little bit over time, but you then have to redraw the map so that they are, we did it within 1%, but within a certain percentage of each other, so that everybody represents roughly the same number of people. The last redistricting done in 2010, it was not nonpartisan. It was bipartisan in as much as you had a Republican House, a Democratic Senate, at the time a Republican governor. That was the map that was passed, and it's the map under which we have run since then. There have been proposals over the years for a nonpartisan commission. They take sort of two approaches. One would be that the commission actually draws the map, and then the map comes to us either in some way, either directly through a new constitutional amendment or as an up-down vote by us. The second would be that the commission could give us advice, but ultimately we have to draw the map. And in some places, the commission would draw a map that we could use for advice. Just so you know, there have been some Supreme Court cases just in the last, 5 or 6 weeks, it just happened, about the Virginia congressional map, which it was not that case that went up, it was an Alabama case that went up. But when the Alabama case came down, they've modified some of the rules with regards to majority-minority districts, what you have to do, what you can't do, what are the rules for drawing the black seats. That's the issue. I have said before, and I'll say again, I am prepared for any and all advice that you all could give, either formally or informally, and that would both mean literally here's a map that we like, or here are the priorities we want you to set. And so, for instance, you could set the priority that it be competitive. That's certainly one. Some people say, I want the districts to be as competitive as possible. Others would say, I want them to be unified counties or cities, so we should, as much as possible, keep Albemarle together, keep Green together, keep Flavanna together. The third would be they should look good. Everybody's seen the districts that kind of to string along. I will tell you that, and I'm not trying to hide the ball, but that's as far as I'm willing to go. I think that ultimately we should design the map and vote on it, but I'll take advice from anybody, whether it be formal or otherwise. I would encourage you all, since this may not just wait till the next census, but actually be coming up in the near future, some of those are in conflict. So if you say, I want the most competitive districts possible, that is a goal to which we could work, but the districts in many cases will not look very good, and our community is a good example. If you want to make the city of Charlottesville district competitive, it is the second or third most Democratic city in the state. You will have to split it up 2, 3, maybe even 4 ways. I know what that is. They call it pizza slicing. You kind of take a slice in and go all the way out. If you want to maintain communities of interest, which would be the city gets its own district, and then you add in as much as you can the county, that's a different goal. But I would welcome your feedback on that. But again, not to hide the ball. I think it's appropriate to take feedback, as much input as we possibly can. I wouldn't object to any commissions that give us advice, but I wouldn't think it appropriate to cede the authority over to them altogether. Thank you.
For me, I think I've taken a position and voted or introduced bills that would create an independent commission. I think that's a better way of doing it. I think you see the ramifications of redistricting and when I showed you up on the map where you've got basically a state that's split right down the middle, but you've got a House of Delegates that has 67 Republicans in it and 32 Democrats. I think that if you take a look at some of the things that were attempted in the last session, there's a senator right close to us who tried to essentially gerrymander changes in his district ostensibly to remove split precincts. But really what he was trying to do is create more Republican voters in his district. That was a pretty big change. Most of the changes we saw in the bills that came to us this year were technical minor changes, but this was a pretty big change. The governor has vetoed that bill, as well as every single redistricting bill that's come through. I think what is happening out there is that we've got a couple of court cases now in Virginia. One is the federal court's already ruled that the Virginia congressional map is unconstitutionally drawn. Pure and simple. And the Alabama case that went to the Supreme Court basically used the same logic to overturn the Alabama plan. So I don't think the congressional plan is going to be, I don't think we're going back to the old congressional plan. I think we're going to have to redraw those districts. But there is also another suit that is percolating through. It hasn't had a hearing yet that contests the House of Delegates districts. If that happened, if the court rules similarly using the logic of the Alabama Supreme Court case, then we're going to be redrawing the House of Delegates districts. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means it may be an opportunity to get an independent commission, because maybe people will be so worried about what their districts are going to be looking like, they'd rather have an independent commission drawing it than the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia drawing his own lines, or it ending up in the courts if there's no agreement. So there's a lot of really interesting politics that are going to go on in the General Assembly over the next 6 months to a year. But the people in control of the Republican House really don't support an independent commission. And ironically, a lot of Democrats in the Senate haven't supported an independent commission in the past either, because when they were in control, they wanted to draw the lines. And, you know, that's the way they do it. But for me, I don't think that, you know, we should let the voters choose us and not let us choose our voters.
One of the issues would be, if the court tosses the map and if it gets redrawn, you might actually see us run in successive years, because that happened not this time, but in 1990, they ran in 91, 92, 93, because what happened was they threw the plan out from the 91 plan, they ran again as soon as they could, in our case that'd be 2016, and then you get back sort of on the normal cycle in 2017. So you might have the great joy of Virginia has elections every year, so at least it's not a... That's right.
I'll be three more of these.
That's right. Thank you. That's all.
Well, I don't think we've touched on the ethics issue yet. I have a suggestion and question for both of you. It wasn't too long ago that Virginia was ranked about 47th in integrity in the ethics in the state of, in the union. We have made some inroads into this. But my question to both of you is, are you satisfied with the inroads we have made? And if you're not, how much further would you go? My suggestion is that when I contribute to your campaign, I want you to use it for campaign. I don't want you to use it for a family birthday party, unless it's mine.
When's your birthday? So the question is, you know, are we satisfied? Well, first of all, I've heard that statistic about 47th. I mean, I frankly take a little issue with that. I mean, I know we have our challenges in here. You know, we had Phil Hamilton got convicted. He was, you know, he was high up in the Appropriations Committee, and he got convicted because he put something in the budget to create a job at a university that he then got, which was a problem. And he's serving, you know, he's serving a lot of time in prison for that. And, of course, we had McDonald, and people disagree about whether he should have been charged, whether he should have been convicted, whether he should spend as much time. But I think the reason why we rank 47th is we don't have any limits on campaign contributions. I think that's the reason. I don't think that we're any worse than any of these other states. I mean, you know, New Jersey? How can we be worse than New Jersey? But we do have our challenges, and I think that we have an obligation to figure out a way that we can restore some of the trust that a lot of people have had in their elected officials in Virginia. People don't think of us the same way they think of Congress, and they don't think of us in the same way they think about New Jersey or Chicago or something like that. So we've got a challenge. Now, we tried to do some things last year. It improved on the law. It didn't solve everything. So we're back again this year. It improves on the law. It doesn't solve all the problems. I mean, I have concerns about some of the trips that some of my colleagues take to France, for example, to go and visit a uranium mine in the south of France that's now shuttered and, you know, it's all replanted over. But spend a whole bunch of time getting briefed in Paris about the same thing. I mean, I have some issues with that. I like to joke that, you know, my putting stroke needs a lot of work, but I don't want Dominion to pay for me to fly to the Masters to give me lessons. Or maybe I do, but I can't. And so those are some of the things we got to solve. I think we might have tried to figure out a way to create an independent commission that would review some of these trips in advance, or that might have the ability to look at some of the things that go on more in more detail. We have a system that relies on transparency. We have to report all of the gifts we take and all of the contributions we get, but that doesn't necessarily solve all the problems. So you take it one step at a time. We did some things last year. We've done some things this year. The governor has improved on that, and we'll be back again next year trying to tweak it some more and try to make it better.
Yes, I mean, I think this is another one where the initial answer, oh, I take anything, right? I mean, that would, I think most people read in the newspaper, so if, then it's clearly, I think, what some of the jurors said about McDonald. If he hadn't been the governor, he wouldn't have gotten these gifts. And I don't know that tangible gifts, meaning stuff, I don't. Dave Albo once said he's never gotten a tangible gift that he actually kind of wanted or knew what to do with. I mean, the T-shirt, you know, the T-shirts and the baseball caps and the mugs and the apple butter from the 4-H and all the rest of it. There is two issues, I think, that make it a little more complicated. The first would be, I agree with David, you don't need to go to Paris to get a PowerPoint presentation. I mean, it doesn't pass any straight face test or smell test or whatever you want to call it. I don't see any reason you need to go to the Masters to have some quality time with someone that knows about an issue, which is what we otherwise call lobbyists. In other words, if a lobbyist wants to talk with us, they can meet us in our office in Charlottesville. We don't need to take those trips. I have never gone on one of these. There's sort of legislatures get together. There's 5,000 some odd state legislators, and we swap ideas at these legislative meetings in St. Louis and whatnot. I've never gone. That's probably worthwhile. There's probably some value to getting best practices. So Indiana has done something very clever on tax policy. Rather than in one by one, they see all of us. It might be useful to get us all in a room. That, I think, probably crosses on the good side of the, whether it's a useful trip or a boondoggle. The part that we actually spend a lot of time on are meetings. And I know this sounds crazy, but as soon as I say it, you'll understand. When I go to the Rotary Club or the Raritan Club or some other club and eat breakfast with them or eat lunch with them, and then they talk to me about what their legislative priorities are, leave out all the names on it. That's a group that just bought me something of value, and then they were giving me legislative priorities. We actually spend a lot of time on that one because, I mean, for the last year, if you've seen me at some of these events, you'll see me with a brown bag. And I'm not trying to show off. What I'm saying is I don't know what the rules are going to be. I'm not making any aspersions to anybody else. But until we kind of figure out what the rules are, I don't even want your coffee. I don't want your tea. And everybody says, well, that's crazy. And I say, I understand, but that's a gift. We need to figure out. And so it's sort of where we came down was we're going to continue to allow that. I've never heard somebody say that the $12 buffet dinner is a problem. Now, maybe someone in here has that as a problem. It's not been the problem. I haven't heard someone say the baseball cap or the T-shirt or the apple butter is the problem. And again, if that's your problem, that's fine. But that's not what most people are worried about. They're worried about the steak dinner where the lobbyists are whispering in our ears and giving access that people think they don't have. I mean, isn't that that's the issue? And then the rest of it would be the fancy trips for Dominion and then the really big gifts. I don't know what it would be, but something tangible that actually has value. So the issue this year would be to have a $100 cap. You still have the reporting requirement of anything over 50. Is that we had so many back and forths that actually we're all kind of waiting until the governor signs and then we can sort of incorporate it. But can't take anything over 50. So under 50 is, we'll just call it the de minimis level. That's the little bitty stuff. But over 100, you just can't take. And if that means no dinners over $100, well, that's not so bad, right? I mean, there are some exceptions for when you're getting an award, like some of these trophies and plaques that we get. It's hard to buy a plaque anymore that's less than $100. There's some other exceptions for if you're the speaker at the dinner, they can give you food. They can't give you anything else, but they can give you the food. It's called a publicly, what's the term? The publicly attended event.
Yeah.
We stole some. We stole something from the attended events. From the feds. They have a lot of rules, and we don't often find them helpful. This was a place they've thought about this an awful lot, and so they said that an event with a bunch of people where you're just one of the people is one thing. It's very different than if you have a special private dinner. And I'm with David. I think we'll continue to work on this. It's you're still not going to catch it. When we're both lawyers, there's something called legal ethics. You take legal ethics classes, and people always laugh. You've got to have classes to make you ethical. It's not so much that as to identify the issues you may not think about. And so if you went to a fancy dinner, I don't mean the lobbyist dinner, but we went to a Chamber of Commerce dinner or something where it turns out that it's an $80 dinner, I don't know that I would have thought of that as a gift until we started talking about it. And it is a gift. Somebody paid for it. I didn't pay for it. I wouldn't have got it if I wasn't a delegate. I think that's what better rules will do. It'll help us flag issues to see, and hopefully what we've discovered, one last thing, and this probably is more than you asked for, but the rules that under which Bob McDonald was prosecuted are federal. So the truth is nothing we do impacts what the federal prosecutor will do. We could set up easy rules or hard rules. It'll be the federal rules. We at least tried to align them more so that as people comply with the state rules, they're less likely to trip across a federal rule. Now, McDonald's case is going up on appeal. The court will either accept what the district court did or set up some new rules, and we'll all be watching just to make sure we understand what does it mean when you set up a meeting for somebody? What does it mean when you do something that you do for everybody else, but you did it for a guy who was a donor? What are those rules? But the U.S. Attorney's offices have not been kind of chasing every single case around the country. They've obviously got some cases they're looking at, and so we'll be watching what they do too.
Gary, just one more comment about this. You know, we're going to cite Dave Albo, he's a friend of ours on the courts committee. Albo says, you know, a bribe is a bribe is a bribe. I mean, it's against the law. Yeah. And there are some things that are pretty bright line. There are other things that are real judgment calls. And it's very difficult to legislate ethical behavior. Because even if you're not violating the law, there are some things you shouldn't be doing anyway, because it just raises the appearance of impropriety. But I can tell you this, and this plays a role in it too. You know, a lot of people talk about how this country is becoming more polarized, and part of the reason it's becoming more polarized is people don't have relationships anymore. They don't feel like they don't develop ways that they can trust each other anymore. Sometimes you can create so many rules that you provide a disincentive for this creation of trust. Now, I don't want to get too academic or intellectual about this, but anybody who's taken an anthropology course or a sociology course or has tried to interact with people from another country, you know that gift-giving is an important element of the development of a relationship. You know, I went to Ghana a couple years ago. You know, and as the mayor, I went to see the father, former mayor of Charlottesville, I went to see the town fathers. And they gave me this huge wooden carving of that represented Winneba, Ghana. It must have been worth hundreds of dollars. Now, what am I going to do in that situation? Am I going to say, I can't take this? You know, what am I going to, I know Rob walks around with that bag. But you know, I mean, if people want to give you, you know, a cup of coffee or a chocolate or something like that, what are you going to do? You run the risk of insulting people along the way. It's one thing for the lobbyists because they, you know, they know what they're doing. But for other people, how many times have you, when running for office, you've gone into somebody's house, and they offer you their special dinner, and you're going to turn it down? You know, I mean, it's part of building this relationship. So you got to be really careful as we go through it. We're going to try to establish bright lines, but they don't lend themselves all the time to the clear decisions we need to make. So please be patient with us.
I'm not aware of this one being a partisan issue at all. I think that everything David and I have said about the difficulties don't mean we can't get rid of the clear. I mean, there's no reason to go to Augusta National. We're using that as a shorthand. Every year, Dominion takes a couple people to Augusta National. If you're looking for the single worst trip besides the Paris trip, that's it. There is no, I can't think of a excuse for that except it's legal and people like to do it, which is not a reason. That's why we have laws, we change them. So don't, just because it's difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't keep working on it. I like to think we are working on it, and that's all. Thanks.
Can we have a show of hands of people who have additional questions? The gentleman in the blue shirt.
Thank you both for the information that you provided, but especially for the spirit of the day and the exchange. Thank you. I have a question about a bill that's going to come up next week, I guess. It's amended, HB 1702, that I think was passed unanimously, perhaps by both House and Senate. But I gather that some language from Delegate Toscano has been added to the bill that will allow the Virginia State Police to perform voluntary background checks at the request of someone who is attending a gun show. The state police, I understand, are already at the gun shows and certainly favor this kind of a change, but particularly for Delegate Bell, with whom we've had some disagreements about gun violence. I know you've supported background checks in the original language, and I wanted to ask if you can support these voluntary background checks in this amendment to HB 1702.
I haven't seen it. I'm sorry. I'm trying to pull it up. I'd like to see the language, and even then probably would not feel comfortable making a snap judgment while I sit here. But, I mean, if you want to follow up with me or something, I'm happy to look at it.
Or,
right? I can get it, although I don't... I'm usually unwilling to sit here in front of people and read something for the first time and make a decision, but I've not read that language yet. I assume you would be in favor of the bill, or excuse me, in favor of the amendment?
Yes, I certainly feel like we need to have much better background checks. I would prefer a federal law that required universal background checks, but at least to make some headway here in Virginia to ensure better as best we can that guns that are sold at gun shows in particular don't wind up in the hands of criminals and domestic abusers and folks like that who are going to cause trouble. And that the statistics say that's what happens. And maybe Delegate Toscano has that language at hand.
I'll be happy to look at it, David. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I had a bill in that didn't even get a formal vote in the subcommittee on militia and police. And just so people understand, I'm not an expert on gun shows, but the way I understand it, if you're a licensed dealer at a gun show and somebody wants to buy a gun from you, you have to do a records check, a background check. If you're not a licensed dealer and you're a private seller at a gun show, you don't have to do a records check if somebody comes to try to buy a gun from you. That's the infamous gun show loophole that everybody talks about. You know, maybe it's not the proper way to describe it, but that's it. If you're a private seller and you've got a table and you can sell that gun to whoever comes up. Now, what my bill would have done is it would have said, okay, I'm a private seller, okay? I've got my guns out here, and somebody comes up to me, and they want to buy a gun. And based on how I'm reading that person, I'm not sure I want to sell that gun to that person. So I say to the state police, who are over in the corner, would you perform a background check on this gentleman, I'm using gentleman, to see if there's any problem before I sell him that gun? And the state police go ahead and they run the background check and they report back. And then the person can either sell or not sell, okay? When the bill was introduced, the governor had previously put money in the budget to pay for it. It was $100,000 or something for the state police to do these things. That bill never got out of committee. So what the governor has done is he's put the language of the bill that I had introduced into some other piece of legislation that's going to be considered on the floor next week. And we'll just see where it goes. I mean, I think that of any of the pieces of legislation that people shouldn't have a problem with, it'd be something like this that would be totally voluntary. I mean, a private seller doesn't have to ask the state police. He could just sell the gun. But if he wants to, he can say, help me out. Do that search. I don't have the money to do the search. You do the search for me. Tell me what it is, and then I'll make a decision.
We have time for one more question.
I'm a little ashamed. I've been here 15 years, and I can't get the New Yorker out of me. So I apologize profusely. I wish I could promise another 15 years we'll do it, but I don't think so. I just want to say, I went to, what I got upset about was I went to the Merck meeting. We had a couple of things that are really kind of cool. We've had a Medicaid committee for quite some time, led by Landis, to get Medicaid expenses down. And actually, you know, they've been working on that a while, even before the expansion, which is kind of really kind of cool that they've been doing this. And I heard five different, I'll ask a question, but I want to ask that you, whether Delegate Bell, there were five different healthcare systems that got up and talked about how they could handle, how they're handling the Medicaid folks, and how they could handle more. Like, they already cut a tremendous amount of expenses. So I think Virginia, I was pretty proud to hear it, that we're doing a pretty good job about lowering Medicaid expenses per person. So do you think you could look into that? The question is, do you think you'd look into that and have as much pride in what we're doing as I do?
Well, sure. I mean, if we have found ways to reduce costs, that's a great thing. And if we can reduce the increasing costs of Medicaid going forward, I mean, Virginia's economy grows, the state budget grows. I've got the numbers. I mean, the state budget has grown during my tenure from $47 billion to $95 billion. I mean, that's in the four, and it's 14 years, and there's been substantial inflation and substantial population growth, but I forget the most recent figure, but 22% above both of those is just growth, growth in budget, past inflation plus population growth. If we can find a way to get the numbers to level off some, not even all, but just some, if Medicaid would just grow at the size of the rest of the budget, we wouldn't be having this conversation because we would be saying we can have everything for everybody. More Medicaid, more roads, more schools, tax cuts, all of it. So sure, if we can find ways to cut. Now, I will tell you that there have been academic studies and they've done sort of pilot projects and whatnot around the country. The changes necessary to truly rein in Medicaid growth that I have seen are not anything that anybody wants to do. I mean, it involves very substantial changes to the way the program is delivered and the benefits that people receive and how they qualify and all of those. I mean, those are the things that it will take. And it involves, again, existing beneficiaries, not even the new ones, but the existing beneficiaries. But sure, no, I mean, anything we can do that I think that does something to rein in the growth of the program would be both a point of pride for Virginia and something we would share at these legislative conferences we were talking about.
It is true that we have put a number of reforms in place in the last several years in the Medicaid arena. We actually have what they call booked the savings into the budget. So, you know, we're recognizing these savings. Several years ago when this Medicaid Innovation Reform Commission was established, its charge was to take a look and develop these plans to save money. And if these plans work to save money, there would be consideration of expansion of Medicaid. What's happened is that we've been saving money, but we're still rejecting Medicaid. You know, that being said, I have to acknowledge that Delegate Bell has a point about the money. I mean, you got to be careful about the long term. But you can't be so careful about the long term that you forget what you're doing in the short term. We are leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table that's our money, that it's just staying in Washington or it's going somewhere else that we could bring back here. And in the process, we are creating problems in our own budget. If we had taken Medicaid expansion, we would have brought immediately over $100 million to the state budget that goes to pay for indigent care. That's here, UVA. That helps UVA. Because of that, we're paying for it with our state dollars. So that is money that we could have used otherwise to pay for, you know, more things in K through 12 or more state police or whatever you wanted to expend the money on. So we're, you know, we're not being fiscally responsible because we're not taking our own money back and using it and instead taking money that's going to be used in the state budget we couldn't use for other things. So, you know, long term, we got a problem because we got a lot of people on Medicaid and they're getting older and it's going to cost more money. But in the short term, we're leaving that money on the table that we could use to help people right now.
David and Rob, thank you very much. You have provided us with a level of detail, sophistication, practical considerations, and subtleties that we wouldn't get by reading any newspaper. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.